This is William Grant Ray reading my article Parents and Peers, A Kantian Moral Development, originally published in the Open Access Journal of Ethics and Social Philosophy. For purposes of this recording, footnotes are omitted. Epigraph. The man who believes himself endowed with an autonomous will thus places himself in another order of things and relates himself to determining grounds of an entirely different sort from when he perceives himself as a phenomenon. The fact that he has to represent and think everything in this twofold way is not at all contradictory, for it rests in the first place on his consciousness of himself as an object affected by the senses, in the second on the consciousness of himself as an intelligence, that is, as an active subject, who in using reason is freed from any passive attachment to sensory impressions. Thus, in line with the basic orientation of the transcendental method, here too, determination of the object is the result of the mediation of the analysis of judgment. Ernst Cassirer, Kant's Life and Thought. How do we become moral persons, performing acts that are our own, endowed with duties, and standing in relations of reciprocal accountability? This is a developmental question. Any satisfying answer will have to capture some change in kind in a mess of actual changes of apparent degree. Eventually, a number of grains of sand becomes a heap, but it will not be our task to identify that number, nor need we suppose that it is identifiable. Instead, in offering here a narrative of this development, I will discuss the types of experiences that contribute to and render possible the change in kind, that is, those that lead us to our state of dutiful moral responsibility. Specifically, this essay considers two forms of social relations as relevant contributors to development: relations between the child and their authorities, represented by the figure of the parent, and relations between the child and their equals, represented by the figure of the peer. The project is a partisan one. I intend to propose a theory of moral development for a Kantian practical philosophy, but the extent to which this theory is compatible with other approaches to practical philosophy is left to the judgment of the non-Kantian reader. 25 years ago, David Velleman attempted a project of this kind. In it, he demonstrated the remarkable potential of the Freudian theory of superego formation to explain how we develop into moral persons in the Kantian sense. Some reasons for this potential present themselves rather readily: a faculty psychology, an identity between that which is ideal and that which legislates and prescribes, the interplay of internal and external authority. But something significant also stood in the way: an ostensibly critical incompatibility of Kantian rationalistic commitments and Freud's anti-rationalism. Velleman's reading, however, purged Freud of his anti-rationalism and led to the identification of a rational superego, a kind of personified ideal of practical reason. His innovation consisted in proposing that the superego, an introjected figure of parental authority that presents itself as the voice of conscience, could be seen as containing legislative humanity in us. Other work in the Kantian tradition tries along similar lines to assure compatibility of Freud and Kant in the realm of moral psychology. While I think there's deep insight in this Freudian connection, and I think that the idea of a rational superego plays an indispensable role in offering a story of moral development for Kantian practical philosophy, I think it cannot be the whole story. The trouble is, the Freudian theory of the superego and its formation is a theory that concerns itself only with an authority relation, the parent-child relation. Kantian practical philosophy ultimately concerns itself with persons standing in relations of moral equality and reciprocal recognition. Principles of equality and reciprocity are not those characterizing relations of authority. The parent is not, in the critical development period, an equal. Paternalism and its discontents will resultingly be seen as the reason we cannot account for certain necessary features of a moral psychology capable of autonomous action in relations of authority alone. Though we learn from the parents how to subject impulsiveness to rule, a necessary condition of moral action, we do not yet know how to subject impulsiveness to rule recognized as our own, a sufficient condition of moral action. There is, however, another great tradition of thinking through the psychology of moral development that has been neglected in these investigations. one that offers us the resources to overcome this paternalism problem, that of the Piagetian stage theory tradition. Equality and reciprocity characterize peer interaction, which models the active construction and justification of norms rather than passive internalization as in relations with authorities. In relations with equals, I claim, we have the resources to make sense of a moral psychology properly fit for persons, recognized legislators of the laws of their own acts. Nothing perfect, Jean Piaget's account conversely denies contributions from the parental relation that we understand as essential to development. The logic of the Piagetian story, I claim, is such that even the most rational of all moral notions can emerge in peer interaction in complete autonomy from relations of authority. Pache Piaget, this essay will hold that the basis of peer interaction will necessarily include our having gained certain positive psychological resources from authority relations. We begin in the first section by identifying what features a Kantian theory of development will need to explain and what the developed state of personhood must minimally consist in. We find that it will explain 1, the original partitioning of 2 aspects or parts of our person, the legislative and the obedient, and 2, how we come to regard ourselves and others as a unity of these 2 parts. That is, how we come to regard ourselves and others as autonomous, self-legislative, how we're awakened to our own personhood and the personhood of others. We turn in the second section to discuss the parental relation through critical engagement with a Freudian account, represented by Velleman for Kantian practical philosophy. Suitably revising the account for our purposes, we find that the parental relation explains 1. However, due to the paternalism problem, we find that it cannot explain 2. In the parental relation alone, we cannot come to regard ourselves as persons because we stand always under the laws of the parents, whereas persons are subject only to laws they give themselves, alone, or at least along with others. So we attempt in the third section to solve the paternalism problem through engagement with the Piagetian account. We find that in acts of co-legislation with peers, each party is recognized by the other as self-legislative, and in seeing this in the eyes of the other, each can recognize it of themselves. The peer relation will thus explain, too. But in denying positive contributions from parental authorities to moral development, Piaget leaves the basis of this co-legislative activity unexplained. We remedy this in reconciling the contributions of parents and peers, adumbrating the essay's original positive picture of development. Subsequent psychological literature has seen itself loosely divided along these lines: those who look to the parents, and those who look to the peers. The following offers a synthesis of the basic elements of the Freudian and Piagetian theories for a Kantian moral development. Arriving at developed moral personhood is necessarily a result of having had authorities who legislated to us and equals with whom we acted as co-legislators. Section 1, developed moral personhood. An account of moral development attempts to outline the transition from infancy, an undeveloped state, to moral personhood, a developed one. To offer a complete account of development, we'll have to be clear about our conception of moral personhood. Since this essay attempts to provide an account for Kantian practical philosophy, it helps itself to a certain Kantian conception. As exposited in the introduction to the Metaphysics of Morals, for Kant, quote, "A person is a subject whose actions can be imputed to him. Moral personality is therefore nothing other than the freedom of a rational being under moral laws, whereas psychological personality is merely the capacity for being conscious of one's identity in different states of one's existence. From this it follows that a person is subject to no other laws than those he gives to himself, either alone or at least along with others." End quote. Imputability is much like responsibility or accountability. To ask whether an act can be imputed to an agent is to ask about a sense in which she can be regarded as the source of the action. Imputation is, quote, "the judgment by which someone is regarded as the author, causally bearer of an action," close quote. With authorship in mind, we are led to conceptions of autonomy and personhood defined with respect to self-legislation, acting in accordance with laws, principles of action we give ourselves. Self-legislation requires that we be able to conceive of 2 aspects or parts of ourselves. For Kant, an empirical law receiver and an intelligible law giver. In natural persons, this is the distinction between homophenomenon and homonoumenon. We view ourselves under 2 attributes. Quote, First is a sensible being. That is, as a human being, a member of one of the animal species. And secondly, as an intelligible being. The senses cannot attain this latter aspect of a human being. It can be cognized only in morally practical relations, where the incomprehensible property of freedom is revealed by the influence of reason on the inner law-giving will. Now, the human being is a natural being that has reason, homo phenomenon, can be determined by his reason as a cause to actions in the sensible world. But the same human being thought in terms of his moral personality, that is, as a being endowed with inner freedom, homo noumenon, is regarded as a being that can be put under obligation. Close quote. While differing in content and form, one may be reminded of Aristotle's dualistic conception of the soul, distinguishing between the rational and the non-rational. While the human being has reason, quote, they evidently also have some other part that is by nature something apart from reason, unquote. The person, despite their consisting in two parts, is still unified, and the non-rational part, quote, shares in reason in a way, that it will have reason by listening to reason as to a father, unquote. Similarly, homo phenomenon is defined as a natural being that has reason in the sense of being determined by reason. A Kantian cast of the two-part distinction is that of an ideal, intelligible legislator and that of a real, empirical obedient, their unity consisting in that which may be self-legislative. We see many of the famous tensions of Kantian practical philosophy rooted in this basic conception of what it means to be a person, mere animality and impulse on the one hand, rationality and lawfulness on the other. Of course, infants and children, as we well know, are already impulsive. They are born a member of the animal species human being. One question for a theory of development thereby becomes, how is it that the infant eventually becomes a member of the rational, intelligible community of ends? If we assume that it is possible for such membership never to be attained, what types of experiences occasion this development? What explains the relevant partitioning of moral psychological life into these two conceptually distinguishable parts, acquiring a legislative figure, a moral authority subjecting impulsiveness to lawfulness? How do we end up such that, quote, morally practical reason in us is humanity, homo noumenon, that gives laws to us, close quote? It is this aspect of the person that just is constituted by the moral law, the true ideal of pure practical reason personified. In coming to these questions as partially guiding questions of moral development, it is shown that Kantian theory already contains an understanding of the ideal of morally practical reason as a figure resembling that of the Freudian ego ideal, the ideal of human personality as such. Though we will take the parental relation to answer the above questions, explaining the partitioning of our moral psychology into these two parts, it will not explain how we become a recognized unity of them, ultimately self-legislative, and thus in relations of reciprocal accountability. The person in their unity is a member of a real rational community and its unity. In such a community, one is called to justify one's actions before others, and one is called to hold the acts of others liable to assessment in light of principles. To qualify for membership, one must recognize oneself and be recognized by others as both legislator and obedient in the selfsame entity, as self-legislative. Moral communities require conceiving of members as entities capable of both giving laws, a capacity necessary for participating in the cooperative process, for engaging in joint lawmaking, and as entities capable of receiving and realizing laws, a capacity necessary for acting in accordance with the principles jointly constructed by such a community. Finally, it requires identifying these members as simultaneously the two, as those who not only receive the laws, but who receive the laws as their own. This is what separates a free community of equals, a community of ends, from a despotism. This final requirement substantially expresses the necessity of recognizing the person as a unity. Here, I will argue, we need relations of equality. Here we need the peers. According to Kant, a person acts under the idea of freedom. On our more specific conception, to act under a recognition of oneself as a self-legislator, as a unity of lawgiver and receiver, is to act under the idea of freedom. Importantly, Kant claims, we are, quote, really free in a practical sense, unquote, acting under the mere idea of freedom. We must act as if we were free, as we must hold the same practical laws to us as would hold for the actually free, and, quote, thus we can escape here from the burden that weighs upon theory. The conception of the person offered above is not centrally ontological, but practical. In practical life, you do not treat yourself or others as merely bodily, but also as abstractions, social identities, worlds of thought, and authors of action, among myriad other dizzying, unexplained sorts. It is also here that I avoid the burden that weighs upon theory. A genealogy of moral development does not have to demonstrate how we mystically become willers independent of causal chains, but instead must demonstrate how we become beings who must regard themselves as autonomous willers. This recognition is enough for truly practical freedom. It is clear that an infant cannot be identified with this condition. However, somehow along the way, at least some human beings develop into the kinds of creatures who, at least implicitly, regard themselves as choosing courses of action on the basis of their own reasons, and can be held to justificatory standards for those reasons. Somehow, we may develop into the kinds of creatures that can have our actions imputed to us, and that stand under public moral principles. Though we surely have some natural tendency toward this development, a theory of development will clarify some material conditions from which personhood arises on the occasion, i.e., it will clarify what must happen in experience before we're awakened to our personhood and the personhood of others. In our theory, we consider two sorts of relationships that developing children have, relations with authorities and relations with equals, whose contributions are understood as distinct. Further, in our narrative, authorities and equals take on special and evocative characters, the parents and the peers. The figure of the parent and the figure of the peer in this essay are reductive. They're not the same as a given parent or a given peer. In the progress of normal development, an actual parent eventually becomes a peer. Nevertheless, especially earlier in development, an essential characteristic of a parent-child relation is that it takes the form of a relation of authority. The parent has a right to rule. Section 2, the role of the parents. The child, it is thought, is raised by the parents, and this has a transparently developmental connotation. In an important sense, parents have final say concerning what ends are set for the child and by what rules they can pursue them, two elemental features of practical life. It is unsurprising, then, that the Freudian tradition would think to center this relation. Section 2.1, irrational superego. On an orthodox Freudian view, psychoanalysis is concerned with means and not ends. It may explain where our motivations come from and equip us to do something about those perceived destructive motives we wish to reform or uproot. But it tells us nothing about whether those motives are moral or immoral, rational or irrational in the Kantian sense. All motives of the organism's action originate in external stimuli and biological instinct, stimulus that arises from within the organism itself. Where the two fundamental forms of instinct are self-preservative and sexual, in terms of which more, quote, highly specialized motives can be unproblematically dissected. Here, considerations of autonomy and heteronomy, or rationality and irrationality in the Kantian sense, seem inoperative. On an orthodox Freudian view, the critical account of moral development consists in our introjection of the authority of the parent. Introjection is a process by which one unconsciously internalizes representational images of others. And in the case of moral development, the child internalizes a picture of the parent, for Freud, especially the father, as a disciplining authority, an object of fear. The ego is impelled to introject the parent by the irrational sexual impulses of the id, who takes the parent as its first object. Though the parent becomes desexualized when introjected, quote, their strength, their severity, their inclination to supervise and punish, close quote, remain. The picture so internalized now lives in the child's head as an independent agency and fixture of its psyche, the superego. When the child considers acting against the laws of this authority, so the Toy Story goes, they hear the voice of the father as the voice of conscience, commanding them against it. The ego and id's impetus to so act comes into conflict with this voice, and this produces feelings of anxiety and guilt. On an orthodox Freudian view, the formation of the superego has a destructive effect on the ego and id. The ego is burdened with conscience anxiety and consciousness of guilt, and it's now tasked to negotiate, quote, the claims of the three agencies which it serves, close quote, itself, the id, and the superego. It has thereby introduced a new set of conflicts for itself to adjudicate. Anxiety and guilt arise from the fact that the voice is not just of a disciplinarian to be feared. It belongs to someone the child wishes desperately to emulate. The child seeks to do as the father does. That is, the parent is not only internalized into the superego as disciplinarian, an object of fear, the image of the parent is also internalized as the ego ideal, an object of admiration. But the child cannot be like the parent. The model they have is of an authoritative adult, and they are no authority and no adult. There is a necessary distance between the ego and its demanding ideal, the superego. The child lives in fear of an unsatisfiable ideal, an ideal they do not realize is of their own creation, one that stands to discipline them for failing to satisfy it. Moral authority gets its first grip on us by way of the ego's apparently irrational fear of its own unconscious creation. The tone of this orthodox Freudian account intimates a moral life that is dark and forbidding, and not exactly moral in the Kantian sense. Amongst other revisionary work, one attempt to make use of the Freudian account for Kantian purposes is of special importance to this essay, Velleman's synthesis in Irrational Superego. The success of such a synthesis, according to Velleman, depends on two conditions. Quote, on Freud's side, that the ideals incorporated into the superego include an ideal of practical reason, and on Kant's side, that the categorical imperative, which is an ideal of practical reason, take the form of an ego ideal. Close quote. The latter condition having been met in the first section, Velleman's innovation consists in meeting the former. That is, in ensuring that the orthodox Freudian account may be, quote, purged of its anti-rationalism, unquote. Specifically, on the orthodox account, the ideals internalized into the superego are representations of actually existing social norms and conventions, quote, of social respectability or conventional propriety, close quote. Velleman hopes to demonstrate that what is internalized can contain an ideal of practical reason, an ideal of personhood as rational nature. On Velleman's view, when a child internalizes the authority of the parent, this contains an ideal of humanity. When the parent loves and sacrifices for the child, when they have concern for the child's needs, aside their personal interests, they thereby treat the child as an end in itself. It is this capacity that the child responds to in idealizing the parent. An essential part of what the child takes in is, quote, nothing other than their practical reason, by which their immediate self-gratification is subordinated to rational requirements embodied in another person, unquote. The ideals internalized thereby contain the categorical imperative, which just is a description of the capacity to take persons as ends. We may internalize a figure of our parents as an ideal because as children, we idealize our parents. In the earliest stages, though they are in fact imperfect authorities, we take their word as word, with a capital W. Quote, although the child may overvalue his parents as the noblest and loveliest specimens of humanity, he does not err in loving them to begin with as specimens of humanity, in the Kantian sense of the word. And when he later internalizes their tin nobility and paper loveliness, he must also internalize their humanity, which is pure gold, a standard not to be superseded by other ideals. Close quote. Velleman thinks the Freudian theory offers a valuable psychological model for three central features of Kantian practical philosophy. The first is the moral law's dual status as a prescription and an ideal. The moral law tells us what to do. It legislates. But it also describes what an ideal will does. Its prescriptive force is justified by its status as an ideal. In presenting the rational superego as a special unity of the superego and ego ideal, the rational superego tells us what to do, and it gives us a model to emulate, and the superego has authority by way of its status as an ideal. The second feature involves the interplay between the moral law's necessity and the fact that we give ourselves the law. How are we both bound by the authority of the law and ourselves the authority? How is one both legislator of and obedient to the selfsame law? The rational superego makes this concretely imaginable. The authority of morality is represented as an internalized external authority, and our ability to exercise moral authority over ourselves is explained by the familiar psychological process of internalizing other people. The third feature is the only plausible answer to the question of moral development. Quote, Kantian ethics is an ethics of respecting persons, others as well as ourselves. But what awakens us to the personhood of others, to the fact that the creatures around us are persons like ourselves? Freud gives the only plausible answer to this question. The main theme of Freud's moral theory is that we're inducted into morality by our childhood experience of loving and being loved, the experience without which we would neither idealize nor internalize a parental figure. Love is our introduction to the fact that we're not alone in the world, and morality, as formulated by Kant, is our practical response to that fact. Close quote. Velleman's theory of the rational superego provides a brilliant model of the first two features, the second with some qualification. However, I think it falls short of explaining the third. The parental relation cannot alone explain how we are awakened to our own personhood and the personhood of others. Velleman's explanation is that the child is awakened to their own personhood in witnessing the parent treat them as an object of care, and the child is awakened to the personhood of others in seeing the parents as entitled to make authoritative claims on them. But recall that personhood does not rest in each of these separately. It rests in their recognized unity in the self-same being, the relation of a personified moral authority and a morally considerable being that is not legislative but listens to the legislator, quote, as to a father, unquote. Here arises the paternalism problem. Section 2.2, the paternalism problem. If we are inducted into morality through the love of our parents, and our own moral authority is nothing other than an internalization of our parents' love and idealized authority, we can offer a theory of development that is compatible only with a moral paternalism, a morality of heteronomy. The parent does not relate to the child in the way that persons relate to each other. In relations of persons, each has a duty to respect the autonomy of the other, to respect the fact that the other is subject only to laws they give themselves, alone or at least along with others, and so a duty to allow the other to legislate for themselves. Moral respect is ultimately respect for the other as a moral equal, and the parent and the child do not stand in terms of equality. The parent's love for the child is love for a party more adequately described as a patient, one to whom the parent is called to give laws, and not for a person, one whose developed self-legislative capacity they would be called to categorically respect. And conversely, the child loves and idealizes the parent as an authority, as a lawgiver, not as a whole person. A person is not only one whose autonomy I am required to respect, but also one who is required to respect my autonomy, a moral equal. The figure of the parent, insofar as it always must be someone capable of overruling me, awakens me not to the personhood of others myself, but to moral authorities, the parent, and moral patients, myself. The paternalism problem may be seen both in an analysis of this abstract external relation and in an analysis of the internalized psychical materials. We begin with the former. If moral relations are relations of moral equality, it would be surprising that the child awakens to their moral personhood in a relation of inequality. A moral person, as we have said, acts under the idea of freedom, under the idea of themselves as both legislator of and obedient to that which governs them. The child in the parental relation is precisely not legislator of that which governs them. Legislative power belongs to the parent. The rules of the parent do not require the say or participation or contribution of the child. The child may kick and scream, and the rules may remain justifiable. The child is often made explicitly aware of the fact that mutual justification is not needed because I said so. In such a relation, the child regards the authority over them as outside them and know themselves as an obedient. Moral relations, as relations of equality, are founded more concretely on reciprocal respect and concern. The relation between the parent and the child does not seem to be one in which the child is capable of reciprocating what is offered by the parent. It is, as acknowledged by Velleman, just this sacrificial concern that captures the child's eye. When a parent cares for the infant at considerable self-sacrifice, the infant makes no offer. They do not reciprocally appeal to the interests of the parent. What the parent gains in the dedication of selfless service to the child is surely something immeasurable, but it is cheapened by the term interest, and in such service, what the parent stands to gain is precisely the thing beside the point. The parent should offer their loving care, expecting exactly nothing from the infant as infant in return. Of course, as development proceeds, children increasingly owe their parents gratitude, the completion of chores, displays of love, and so on. This is, however, twinned with the gradual effacing of what is essential to the parent-child relation as an authority relation. Velleman argues that the parent's sacrificial concern for the child treats the child as an end in itself, and the child thereby internalizes the categorical imperative, fully formed in their internalization of the parental figure. But concern aside personal interest is not enough to show full treatment of persons as ends in themselves. I cannot impose my will over that of another adult because I think it in their interest, even if I'm sacrificing my own interests. To treat persons as ends in themselves, I must respect their autonomy, their capacity to set ends for themselves. Kant calls the capacity of humanity to, quote, set itself an end, unquote, an end in itself. By contrast, the parent often has a duty to treat the child paternalistically, not to respect their capacity to set ends for themselves, because this capacity is not yet developed, but to guide development such that the child may eventually govern themselves by moral principles. Because the parent loves the child as a patient, a developing being, and not as a developed person, the parent's love cannot be the vehicle of respect needed for the child to awaken to their own personhood. One may think, is this future-respecting concern not itself respect for the child's capacity to set ends for themselves? Well, I think this confuses the modality of capacity. Even if we take the premise of the question for granted, I think we must still answer negatively. It may appear to be respect for the child's capacity for self-legislation from the parent's perspective, but what is needed is a description from the child's perspective, as they are the party whose experiences are necessary for the internalization of the categorical imperative. And here I think it's safe to say, paternalism appears to the child as just that, paternalism. They see themselves as overridden. They may kick and scream, but the rules remain nonetheless. In the course of development, the parent must give the child space to strike out on their own and make their own mistakes. Increasingly also, they will be owed reasons for rules, but especially in the earliest stages. What matters is that in this relation, the parent always has overridingness. The child must put on the seatbelt, must hold hands while crossing the street. About all of this, there is little to nothing to negotiate. Now, we should not mistake the baby for the bathwater. The rational superego remains an important psychological model for the structure of internal lawgiving. The structure of the authority of homonoumen and over homophenomenon may even be described as a paternalistic structure, and is so described in the Aristotelian analogy, and so rendered explicable in its rudiments by the internalization of parental authority over the child. Homonoumenon begins as the figure of the parent, an ideal and a disciplinarian who gives laws, and homophenomenon, the child, a receiver of laws, subject to rules and obliged to follow them. The child internalizes a picture of parental authority over them, in which an idealized disciplinarian gives laws which a natural being stands under. The relation becomes, in the course of development, the procedure of internal lawgiving, in which we conceive of two aspects of ourselves that make self-legislation possible. The relation is not one of mere power. The child, in loving the parent, idealizes them, and power becomes authority. This is the embryo of practical normativity. Even when, however, we look more specifically to these internalized psychical materials, we still have not quite arrived at a psychology characteristic of personhood. For the child, the internalized authority figure is not seen as an aspect of themselves. The internalized authority is an image of the parent, an interjection bearing their mark, speaking in their voice. The child is equipped to subdue their own animality, and so has acquired some of the relevant psychical materials for self-legislation. They're capable of being disciplined subject to laws, but they regard this subduing as issuing not from their own authority, but from without, from the parent. The child's laws are still in content and form the parent's laws. And in the structure of internal lawgiving at this stage, the legislator is still claimed by the external parental figure. Sole obedience to the external is nothing other than heteronomy. Somehow, the child will have to come to recognize the authority as their own, and thus not remain in obedience to the laws of others, but genuinely impose laws on themselves. The materials provided by the parent will have to be correspondingly transformed. In one minimal sense, the child will have to kill the father. In their practical suppositions, the child must conceive of themselves as the legislator of their own principles of action. This is what it will mean to regard ourselves as autonomous willers, to awaken to our personhood. For that, we'll need a different sort of relation. The parent's core contribution to this account of moral development is thus not in explaining our status as imputable, but is rather in equipping us to subject the childish aspect of ourselves to authoritative rule, abstracting from the question of to whom rule is identified, and so how to be disciplined law receivers. We have now unconsciously internalized the parental figure as the authoritative aspect of our moral psychology. What we have not done is recognize ourselves or others as a real unity of authority and obedience, claiming the former as our own, elevating us as whole persons to membership of a real, rational community, one in which we are really held liable to assessment by our fellows. When the child's laws are still, in the end, the parent's laws, from the second and third personal perspective, it's the parent, not the child, that is regarded as in the end culpable. And from the first personal perspective of the child, they themselves remain legitimately subject to the parent's laws. Paternalism, necessarily a treatment regarding the child as less than fully self-legislative, prevents the child from recognizing its own rational nature, its rational nature as its own. And so the mirror must be held to the child in another way. Section 3. The role of the peers. When a child interacts with peers, here represented by other children, outside of the purview of authorities, the child engages with others by their own power, on their own terms. Relations between equals, between peers, can embody values of cooperation, reciprocity, and mutual respect. Piaget considers this insight scientifically and systematically in The Moral Judgment of the Child. Section 3.1. The Moral Judgment of the Child. Piaget was a Kantian, and so we fortunately do not have to do the work of reconciling his premises with Kantian ones. While orthodox Freudian theory considers children as passive internalizers of already existing social norms, Piaget considers children as active participants in the construction of norms. Genuine moral norms are properties that arise from certain forms of social interaction, those of equality and cooperation. Piaget distinguishes between relations of constraint and cooperation. Quote, "The great difference between constraint and cooperation, or between unilateral respect and mutual respect, is that the first imposes beliefs or rules that are ready-made and to be accepted en bloc, while the second only suggests a method of verification and reciprocal control in the intellectual field, of justification and discussion in the domain of morals. It matters little whether this method be applied immediately to all the rules imposed by the environment or only to one aspect of behavior. Once it has come into existence, it has the right to be applied to everything." Close quote. Recasting the paternalism problem in Piagetian terms, the relation of the parent and the child is a relation of constraint and unilateral respect, and thus it never establishes the method of justification in the domain of conduct. For that, we require cooperative relations, relations of peers. Piaget's discussion of the peers involves an insightful study of games. Children's participation in games opens up for them a field of norms over which they have control. Norms applicable to themselves and other children with whom they play, applicable on conditions of mutual respect. The rules of the game are not rules of the game if participants don't recognize them. Games thereby model at least three critical aspects of moral life: action in accordance with norms, the construction of norms, and the justification of norms that one considers valid. Children must play in accordance with the rules of the game, where they're held liable to assessment by others in light of these rules. The rules of the game are in part a result of deliberation. Often, children don't know the rules entirely, and so must invent and reform them together, or they know them and take up the project of altering them. When children engage in these deliberative procedures, they justify their rule proposals to others and challenge justifications that seem against their interest or not quite right. The playground is the child's primitive moral community, a superficially supervised space of reasons. Studying the playground, Piaget draws a distinction between constitutive and constituted rules. Quote, "There are two kinds of rules, those that are constitutive and render possible the exercise of cooperation, and those that are constituted and are the result of this very exercise. The rules of the square, of the coke, etc., are constituted rules due to mutual consent and capable of being altered by general opinion. The precedence given to justice, as opposed to chance, on the other hand, of effort over easy gain, are constitutive rules. For without this spirit of the game, no cooperation would be possible. Close quote. The notion of constitutive rules here is distinct from its contemporary epistemological usage. In the contemporary sense, a constitutive rule of a game is just the rule that makes the game that game. That is what Piaget calls constituted rules. If we move the rook diagonally in a game of chess, we're not playing chess. Nonetheless, these rules get an important kind of grip on us. There is force to the injunction, we're playing chess, so don't move the rook diagonally. The need for stability of such constituted rules is no match for the awesome imaginations of children at play. Children may be seen playing chess, wherein the king moves two spaces instead of one. Nonetheless, there remain rules that get a kind of inalterable grip on the children's psyche. The second order sort, those that constitute and govern the deliberative cooperative activity by which such alterations and formations are made, the rules without which we are no longer even playing together. Developed moral rules in social life seem to take an analogous form to those of the children's games. Developed moral rules in social life seem to take an analogous form to those of the children's games. Rules concluded through deliberation and that require mutual consent, as well as rules that are necessary conditions of this deliberative activity. If my spouse and I speak at some length to establish the extent of privacy, and each agree never to read the other's journal, we formed a constituted moral rule, one that would be morally dubious to break. This rule could be otherwise, but it was generated in a deliberative space constituted by rules that could not be, those constituting mutual reciprocal respect, constitutive moral rules. Less solid in genealogy, cultural mores may be constituted moral norms. What precisely it means to fail to respect the dignity of another may be vastly different in content in Colombia than in Japan. It may be offensive, in some circumstance, even morally, for an Italian to brush the underneath of their chin with an outward sweep of the fingertips of one hand and yet be a completely meaningless gesture elsewhere. Nonetheless, the constitutive moral rule, to respect the dignity of others, remains constant. The method of verification and reciprocal control in the intellectual field of justification and discussion in the domain of morals, constitutive of relations of cooperation, will come to have the right to be applied to everything. The moral law, for Piaget, is the constitutive rule of cooperative activity, the method of justification in the domain of conduct. Piaget then confronts a problem. Quote, how can these constitutive rules be regarded as themselves the outcome of mutual respect, since they are necessary for the latter's formation? Unquote. His answer is to wave it away. Quote, the difficulty here is purely formal. Between mutual respect and the rules which condition it, there exists a circular relation, analogous to that which holds between organ and function. Unquote. It soon becomes clear why Piaget must dissolve rather than solve the problem. Quote, since cooperation is a method, it's hard to see how it could come into being except by its own exercise. No amount of constraint could determine its emergence. If mutual respect does derive from unilateral respect, it does so by opposition, unquote. Piaget does not have much to identify by way of necessary conditions for the emergence of cooperation, because here he refuses positive, necessary contributions from relations of unilateral respect, i.e. from the parents. Instead, he contends, through a kind of spontaneous and self-reflexive process, cooperation both emerges and creates the conditions for its emergence. This is called the equilibrium-based solution. Now, I struggle to see how the circular relation in question could be anything but a vicious one. If only cooperation could create the conditions for its own emergence, then such conditions would never be created for want of cooperation. The appeal to circularity appears to be a way of pulling rabbits from hats, and indeed, I think it leads Piaget to try to reach for a rabbit himself. The ability of cooperation to spontaneously and self-reflexively develop leads us to the conclusion that, quote, two of three individuals who've lived their entire lives on a desert island will necessarily come up with the idea of justice without implying that they had it in them to start with, unquote. the idea of justice, what Piaget calls the, quote, most rational of all moral norms, unquote, will spontaneously emerge within social relations, even between those who have not been taught or loved or raised, and thus all that is really necessary for moral development is the peers. This seems almost obviously wrong. It is not just the individual, but the society that had to develop to the age of morality. We learn from John Dewey that the path to moral social life was surely long and torturous, and required the communication and transmission of, quote, ideals, hopes, expectations, standards, opinions, from those members of society who are passing out of the group life to those who are coming into it, unquote. Rational interaction was not always a constitutive ideal of social interaction. The young do not have the capacity to survive on a desert island, even physically, without the caring authorities. Quote, how much more, then, is this the case with respect to all the technological, artistic, scientific, and moral achievements of humanity? Unquote. Piaget comes to this rather perplexing position on the relation of constraint to cooperation by first posing a very difficult problem for any developmental account that starts from our premises. Indeed, Piaget considers a conception of the parental contribution that is, in summary, quite similar to our own, that of the first stage of J.M. Baldwin's theory. Here, too, the child acquires conscience in an idealized parental image, becoming accustomed, quote, to the presence of something in him that represents his father, mother, or in general, the law-giving personality, unquote. The trouble is, as Piaget puts it, having thus begun, quote, one cannot escape the following contradiction, namely, that rational logic is itself derived from social processes which it's supposed to free itself in matters of moral psychology, unquote. This is the central challenge set by Piaget. In our story, quote, morality begins with conformity and ends in autonomy. To account for this evolution, we must have an explanation that really suffices to make us understand why constraint gives way to cooperation, unquote. Everyone else, Piaget thinks, has failed to do so, instead giving priority to the relation of constraint over against the relations of cooperation. Piaget bites the bullet on this problem. In the end, constraint does not give way to cooperation by providing its original necessary conditions. Rather, cooperation is the imminent equilibrium of all social relations. If there are ever non-cooperative relations, their inherent instabilities will eventually lead back to cooperation. In my view, Piaget thus errs in just the opposite way, giving undue priority to relations of cooperation. For Piaget, the relation of constraint and its characteristic morality of heteronomy is something merely to be overcome. For this essay, it is instead, to borrow a Hegelian expression, something to be sublated. Cooperation cannot nebulously produce its own necessary conditions, but emerges only on the basis of necessary contributions to development provided by relations of authority. We can give an account of how constraint gives way to cooperation, and we can escape the contradiction that rational logic is itself derived from social processes from which it's supposed to free itself in matters of moral psychology. And in bringing together parents and peers, we will show now how this is concretely imaginable. Section 3.2, Parents and Peers. In the joint construction of norms, co-legislation, we are awakened to and recognize the personhood of others, a respect owed to them and their autonomy. We know that when we stand in terms of equality, we cannot treat another as an obedient of our laws. We cannot treat them as we've learned to treat our animality. Any childish effort to assert our own principles over them is in vain, as we soon learn that they can do otherwise without impediment. In acts of co-legislation, we are also awakened to and recognize our own personhood. We see, in the reflection of the gaze of our co-legislators, our peers, a respect for our own personhood. This is a respect that we could not have before seen in the eyes of authorities, who did not require our consent or participation for the construction of rules, who always in some part had the reins on governance and an intention for guidance. The relation of co-legislation is thus our first relation of moral equality. Co-legislation brings forth the recognition of self-legislation within and toward both parties. The analogous problem to Piaget's conditions of cooperation is this. Do we not already have to be in some sense self-legislative to participate acts of co-legislation? We will not wave this problem away, but answer it. The contribution of the parents has provided what is necessary to participate in acts of co-legislation. The imposition of rule and discipline and the internalization of an idealized parental authority has made discursive, rule-governed activity with the peers possible. The child has an efficient power, even if they do not know it as their own. We can participate in such activity prior to a recognition of ourselves as legislative, because peers recognize the moral authority in us as our own before we do, and we simultaneously return this favor. Two similarly situated children can participate in acts of co-legislation prior to each recognizing the legislative power in them as their own, because they can each see the legislative power of the other as belonging to the other. Finally, the reciprocal recognition of co-legislative activity allows each child to see, in the eyes of the other, a regard for their own legislative power, and in so seeing, recognize it of themselves. In order to participate in, approach, or even consider acts of co-legislation, we must come to the table with some capacity or constitution. And this does not materialize from thin air. It's not within the infant fully formed. It is disciplined and trained by the idealized authority of the parents, and this authority is internalized. If children came to the schoolyard with no authority over the impulsive aspect of themselves, they could not participate in any such joint deliberation. Their consent to the rules of the game would not matter because they would be incapable of giving it. They may be excluded from the beginning or at the point of older or more developed children's recognition of these facts. It is the parent who has a duty to legislate to the young child. As Kant claims in The Pedagogy, the child would otherwise be trapped in its, quote, inner wildness, unquote, its animal nature. It is only by the parent's discipline that the child learns to self-discipline. But without the peers, the child is not quite yet an autonomous person. For the child to be autonomous, they need authority over their own powers. But in the parental relation, it is still the parent who claims his authority. This is captured already by Piaget. In the first stage of the development of the child's sense of justice, the idea of justice is subordinated to adult authority. It's no different from obedience. If the adult says it, it's just. But in the end, quote, the sense of justice requires nothing more for its development than the mutual respect and solidarity which holds among children themselves. It is often at the expense of the adult, and not because of him, that the notions of just and unjust find their way into the youthful mind. In contrast to a given rule, such as the rule of not telling lies, the rule of justice is a sort of imminent condition of social relationships, or a law governing their equilibrium, and as the solidarity between children grows, we shall find this notion of justice gradually emerging in almost complete autonomy. Close quote. Though we diverge from Piaget on their requiring nothing more for its development than the peers, this reveals the way in which the child suitably transforms the materials provided by the parent into genuine autonomy, solidarity among the children themselves, often against and at the expense of the adult. Children keep secrets among themselves, they resolve to break rules and not tattle to the adult, they coordinate to play tricks on the authorities, etc. The development of autonomy often appears as a rebellion against external authority. But why be solidaristic and why rebel? Children originally bring their parents' principles to the schoolyard, but they're challenged by the principles of others, even those of similarly situated children whose principles are also merely inherited. This challenging exposure to the differing principles of others reveals the fault in our assumption that our parents are the noblest and loveliest specimens of humanity, and at least our assumption that their word is word, with a capital W. And so we may depart from them not from mere impulse, but from genuine reasons, principal differences of our own. As the ideality of the parent was that which, for the child, licensed their authority, the impetus to rebel is thereby more particularly brought on by an understanding of the parent's imperfection. When the non-ideal nature of the parent is thoroughly understood, the child begins to take legislation into their own hands. Because the challenge comes from equals, parental authority is not merely supplanted by the external authority of another. The challenge is not an imposition, but a disputation. This recognition of the non-ideal nature of the parent thus also motivates solidarity between children. When children bring their parents' principles against each other, the children are reciprocally destabilized, and they thereby find themselves in a common situation. Subjected to authorities and to rules they now find imperfect, subjected regardless of their imperfection, and in turn, in search of principles they can really call their own. This shared developing dominee-like status encourages the solidarity in which children support each other in the effort to part ways from the parent, to stand on their own two feet, not in solitude, but in relation to equals. The good parent seeks for their child the same. The effacing of the parent-child relation is its realization. The turn from constraint to cooperation, from authority to equality, and the escape of the apparent contradiction of morality, quote, deriving from social processes from which it is supposed to free itself in matters of moral psychology, unquote, consists in something of this process, a process of idealization and de-idealization. The first relation transformed power into authority, and idealization conferred legitimacy on the authority's laws. The second relation weakened idealization of the external and turned it inward, where each is recognized as exercising authority of their own, and where legitimacy now depends on the authority of each. The unilateral authority relation was imbued with a truly moral developmental character after the process of idealization, when power became authority. The turn from constraint to cooperation was therefore not an inexplicable transformation from inert power to genuine moral relations, but a relocation of the ideal to its proper place, not a named, voiced conception of an external figure, but an ideal conception recognized as in part constituting ourselves and others, equals, with whom we act and live together, an ideal in light of which we are now licensed to reciprocally hold each other to account. We gain autonomous authority over ourselves when we transcend the yoke of parental authority, when we recognize the laws that govern us as our own, when we recognize ourselves as legislative. But as we require the parents to acquire the power to subject impulsiveness to lawfulness, we have the capacity to rebel against external authority only by first internalizing it. We turn away from an idealized external authority through the embrace of equals, who do not impose their ends on us, but by the conditions of co-legislative activity, respect our capacity to set ends for ourselves, and therein we claim authority over our own powers. True autonomy is the result of both the internalization of parental authority and a rebellion against it. Only with authorities do we learn to take authority over ourselves, and only with equals do we learn that authority is our own. Conclusion. Thus we find that, in part by way of synthesizing the Freudian and the Piagetian, the roles of the parents and peers are not only compatible but complementary, and both needed for moral development. With parents, we learn to be disciplined law receivers. With peers, we learn to be law givers. And in their combination, we become persons, recognizing ourselves as legislative and obedient of the selfsame laws, thus acting under the idea of freedom and relating ourselves to determining grounds of an entirely different sort, earning our membership in the real, rational community of ends.